From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Tallness has always been viewed as an enviable trait. Economic surveys have long revealed that taller people earn more money, and if that's not bad enough, there are some statisticians who claim that the reason for this is that tall people are just plain smarter. Stephen Hall's new book, Size Matters, examines our cultural beliefs and looks at the story behind the statistics. It's published by Houghton Mifflin, and I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show.
My pleasure to be here.
When you say size, are you referring to height alone?
Primarily height, although also physical size in terms of bulk. I don't get into obesity, but mostly just how a child grows and what height he or she attains and at what age they attain those heights.
So if a kid is burly, that's good? Because haven't big, brawny men often been seen as strong, dumb hulks?
In some cases, they have been, but it's interesting that there's been some research suggesting that kids become aware of their physical size, including bulk, very early on. You're talking about age 3, and that it influences their behavioral attitudes, maybe up to age 11 and on into adulthood. So it's something kids are aware of very early on.
So is this instinctual? Because in the light of all the successful small people I could cite, why does size remain so important in our culture?
I think there's a couple of reasons for it. One, I talk about this in the book. I had a conversation with my son when he was 6 years old where he woke up one morning and I just sort of innocently said it looked like he had grown an inch or two overnight. And he said, that's great. I really want to be tall. And I asked him why he wanted to be tall. And he said, because it would be more fun and I could reach for the sky.
And not because his father was short?
And not because his father was short. I don't think kids are aware of that part of it that early on. But what it made me think is that there's probably a very fundamental human desire to be taller that begins in children. And I think it's because children associate limitation with being small, and that the sources or agents of limitation are people that are bigger than them, from older kids to bigger kids to parents. So there's a sort of an inborn psychological desire to be taller, and I think that's part of it.
Well, when you're growing up, those inequities are really very obvious. When boys try to dance with girls who are a foot taller than they are, when a kid, one boy looks down on another boy because he's shorter and makes it clear that the kid is shorter. You begin the book with a personal story of playing a game called British Bulldog in the playground. How's the game played?
Well, the idea of the game was you'd have all the boys in the school line up at one end line, like on a basketball court, and then one boy would be in the middle. And at an agreed-upon signal, all the boys would start running across, and the boy in the middle would try to tackle one of the boys. And then if you were tackled, you stayed in the middle, and then it just kept going back and forth until everyone was tackled. When I played this game at this particular school, I realized that there was only one other boy in the school that I could tackle because he was smaller than me. And it made an impression on me because I realized it wasn't just an issue on the playground, but it then becomes an issue of social hierarchy among boys. It's a very physical society.
And in the bio in the book, you describe yourself as 5'5 3/4". Now, only somebody who considers himself short would go to that 3/4".
Well, I
would say if you were 6'3", you'd say 6'1".
Let's put it this way. If you went back over some of my earlier driver's license, you might have found rounded up an inch or two. The reason I was so precise in that particular instance, however, is that for the book, I actually got my adult height measured. And I went down to Children's Hospital of Philadelphia to get measured. You say, why do you go to Philadelphia? You live in New York. Is there some place you could have gone here? But I went to a particular group of doctors in Philadelphia because they had published a study a couple of years ago showing that in family practices in the United States, doctors who measure children get it wrong about 70% of the time. And a lot of people might think, big deal, that, you know, we're not talking about a blood test or anything. We're just talking about measuring a child's height. But actually, the measurement of a child's height as he or she is growing is one of the most fundamentally important measures of health. So the fact that you get it wrong is actually an important thing.
Well, you distinguish between final height and timing of growth. What is more important in the end?
I think, you know, in the whole course of the book, I realized that there are certain periods of growth where the psychological dimension is very important. And I think people tend to forget that the timing and rate of a child's growth really has important psychosocial implications, not only during childhood and adolescence, but on into adulthood. Pubertal timing in particular, if you have early maturation, late maturation, that's a sexual maturation, but it's also your growth spurt is attached to that. It has, and this is really fairly recent research, it really has long-term psychological implications for the child, both girls and boys.
You refer to an essay Gary Trudeau wrote called My Inner Shrimp. Now, he's over 6 feet tall, isn't he?
He is, but in the essay, which is a beautiful piece of work, he talks about how he was the third shortest kid in high school, didn't have his growth spurt until very late, and spent part of that adolescence kind of in his father's lap crying and complaining about being short. And the point he makes in the essay is that you never leave behind the person you thought you were when you were short.
Same thing happened to me. I became my height. I'm 6'1". When I was 16 years old, I finally achieved it when I was 16 years old, about to enter college, actually. I'm grateful for that because I would have been much shorter. But throughout most of my school career, I'd been the kid, the boy in the middle, not the tallest and not the shortest. And then suddenly I was taller than everyone else, but I no longer could use that.
It's amazing how we kind of overlook the fact that our size at these crucial developmental moments really affects how other people view us and then how we internalize that information, and it really kind of becomes part of our self-concept. And I think during adolescence, as any parent will tell you, kids are so self-conscious about physical difference. And it's not just being small. I use that as a metaphor for being physically different when everyone's paying attention to physical difference.
My guest is Stephen S. Hall. His latest book, Size Matters, How Height Affects the Health, Happiness, and Success of Boys and the Men They Become, published by Houghton Mifflin. And you said this does not apply to women as much as men, but women, tall women, if they're too tall, have problems. But if women are short, everybody remarks on it.
It's not that it's different for women. I think the reason I concentrated on boys, two reasons, actually. One, I could talk about my own personal experiences in terms of getting bullied, briefly being a bully, and would able to talk about it at a sort of an emotional level. The other thing about boys that I think is really important related to size is that, especially during childhood, and then on into adolescence, you see boys on a playground or on an athletic field, and they almost have this need, like respiration, to bump and collide into each other. It's a very physical society, and therefore size is much more part of their developmental psychology because of that, I think.
So what is a good height for a man?
Well, I can tell you what the average height is. The average height of an American male is a little bit above 5'9", and for women it's 5'4". But the question about what's a good height is interesting because one of the things I've tried to do in this book is get people to think about what's normal in terms of growth and not height and whether it's good or bad to be tall.
Well, what constitutes a problem height, a threshold where intervention in the form of human growth hormones might be called upon?
That's a two-part question because the growth hormone was available or has been available in sort of two phases. The first phase up to 1985, all the hormone was isolated from human cadavers. It was extremely rare and was given really only to children who had growth hormone deficiency.
And very expensive.
And it's enormously expensive. Now it's a minimum of about $20,000 a year, and you're talking usually about a course of daily injections for 4 to 6 years. Since 1985, 1985, it's been genetically engineered. That means it's a limitless supply of it. So there's a sort of supply pressure, and there's a new demand pressure because the FDA has approved a use for kids who are unusually short but otherwise medically normal. The technical term is idiopathic short stature. And in fact, one of the pharmaceutical companies distributed a growth chart with a new line on the growth chart at the 1.2 percentile, and that's the percentile at which a child would qualify for this treatment.
And who do you think pushes for it more, the kid or the parents?
I think if children are intensely aware if they're shorter than average or unusually short and are made to feel that way. And there's two components to that. One is sort of the general teasing, which, I think goes on for almost all kids who are physically different in some way. But smaller boys in particular, and the studies have borne this out, tend more likely to be targets of physical bullying. And I think the physical vulnerability and sense of insecurity is very destabilizing to the child and very concerning to parents. So I think that's one of the impetuses for it.
But one of the points you make in this book is that growth patterns are significant, and it's something we can look at before birth, before bullying or anything else occurs, because it's an indicator of health?
Yes. In fact, there's a whole school of thought that kind of came out of England about 20 years ago that birth weight, and particularly low birth weight, seems to increase the likelihood of a child in adulthood developing heart disease, type 2 diabetes, high blood pressure, metabolic syndrome. These are serious chronic diseases of adulthood. It seems to be set in motion by gestation and how well it was occurred.
And this actually came about with a map?
Well, it was an epidemiological map in which they paired early infant mortality in England with the incidence of adult heart disease, and they noticed that there was this overlap, and there's been subsequently a number of epidemiological studies that have shown that low birth weight correlates with these higher risks of disease.
Well, how much of that is genetic, and how much of that is because the mother's nutritional intake wasn't good enough?
Well, I think a lot of it is optimal nutrition. One of the really fascinating things about growth science that I encountered in the course of doing this book, I'm a science writer by profession. I've written about genetics and molecular biology for 20 years, and that's really been kind of the prevailing mainstream science. And human growth and growth science has really not gotten a lot of attention. But what the growth scientists have known for decades, and I think the geneticists are just catching up to now, is that the environment plays an enormous role even in how genes are activated, turned on, and turned off. And in growth, you see this time and time again.
So when a child is 9 pounds at birth, and everybody says, oh, poor mother. Actually, they should say, lucky kid?
Yeah, I think at least the way the statistics are coming out of these studies now indicate on up from, say, 5 pounds, to the difference between 5 and 6, 6 and 7, 7 and 8, at the heavier baby, assuming there's no other issue like gestational diabetes, for example, the larger baby has a less likelihood of developing these diseases in adulthood.
But with modern technology, don't those low-weight babies catch up to normal-weight babies pretty quickly?
They can catch up, but one of the issues, in fact, you mentioned in your introduction, there was a study that came out. It said taller children are smarter. And it was done
I'd like to believe that anyway.
Yeah. That work was done by a couple of economists at Princeton. It came out a couple months ago. I've actually talked to them afterwards because I just want to clarify my understanding of the study. And what they're really saying is that children who grow optimally very early on and probably prenatally have higher cognitive ability, and you can pick this up as early as age 3. So this cuts into play very early on and has a lot to do with optimal nutrition and health of the mother.
My guest is Stephen S. Hall. His latest book, Size Matters, How Height Affects the Health, Happiness, and Success of Boys and the Men They Become. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. My guest is science reporter Stephen S. Hall, who's the author of Merchants of Immortality and 3 other books. He writes frequently for the New York Times Magazine, Discover, and other publications. And his latest is called Size Matters, How Height Affects the Health, Happiness, and Success of Boys and the Men They Become. It is published by Houghton Mifflin. We've gotten a few calls from people who are short and who are really annoyed by what we're saying here. Are there always exceptions to the rule, or are we talking about a kind of a general thing, or are we talking about something that almost always applies?
I'm not sure what they're annoyed about.
I'm 5'6". I'm very happy. I've lived a great life. Nobody ever picked on me.
I talk about this in the book a lot. I don't describe it as necessarily a shortcoming, if you will. What I think happens is short people sometimes, especially boys again, learn early on that they can't get their physical way or they can't get their way physically. And I think it actually cultivates a whole different skill set, which I have to say is not tremendously useful during adolescence, like being smart and a verbally dexterous sense of humor, these sorts of things.
And overcompensating in other ways.
Yeah.
We might call it overcompensating. There's a Napoleonic complex. Is that a real thing?
People talk about that. I prefer not to use the term overcompensation because it's the kind of word that a hierarchy uses to characterize a minority in the same way that during women's liberation, for example, women would be pushy or hysterical or something, or African Americans would be out of place or something. And we would never say that Michael Jordan was overcompensating for the fact that he was only 6'6". So I think determination is an equally valid term. And I think it does speak, there is a certain persistence to behavior. I think you sometimes probably have to feel you have to prove yourself a little bit more.
And we've seen a fair number of short people who've become giant successes, whether it's a Napoleon or a Picasso or any number of people who run major corporations.
Absolutely. There was an interview with Chris Rock, the comedian, in the New York Times Magazine about a month ago. And the question was about, it must have been difficult when your parents had you bused to another school because of the race relations. And he said it was, but I think the real key thing at that point was being the smallest kid, because that really shapes who you become. So it's just suggests how important this is at that time of life.
You trace the idea of growth charts to a French nobleman named Philibert de Montbéliard. Was he just an obsessed dad?
He did actually one of the most brilliant growth charts that had ever been created, even though it had a number of one subject, namely his son. But what he did is he took serial measurements of his son and recorded the dates of it. And
when was this?
This was in the late 18th century. So it was part of the, around 1760. So it was a part of the Enlightenment, when people just began to get interested in measuring in general. But he was able to measure what growth scientists now consider the single most important aspect of growth, which is the rate of growth. Interestingly, a lot of people think that the adolescent growth spurt is kind of the big bang of human growth. But in fact, a baby at the moment of birth is growing twice as fast as an adolescent who's going through their growth spurt.
When did doctors start keeping annual records?
Doctors began, again, during the sort of middle of the 18th century.
So fairly early.
Yeah, primarily in Germany. But the impetus for measuring humans was not so much medical and the care of children. It was much more military and the measurement of soldiers who were being recruited into these very large standing armies in Europe in the middle of the 18th century.
And when you say large standing armies, you mean it in every way. We're talking about the armies, for example, of the Prussian king, Friedrich Wilhelm. He recruited the tallest army in Europe.
Frederick Wilhelm had this obsession with attracting tall soldiers to what was called the Potsdam Giants. It was a special elite unit.
Was he tall himself?
He was very short. He was about 5'5", but he had this fascination. And it played out this way. He would attempt to recruit the tallest Prussian youth, and when that failed, he would ask for donations from other fellow European monarchs. So Peter the Great would send the tallest Russians to him. Then he would buy them from other countries if he couldn't recruit them. And ultimately, he had them kidnapped off the streets of major capitals of Europe and brought to Prussia, where they served in this unit.
Was he trying to breed them as well?
And he also tried to breed them with tall German women in an attempt to sort of an early eugenics program to breed taller Prussians. And interestingly, Charles Darwin was aware of this as probably the first and only human experimentation in eugenics up to the time that he did his writing in the middle of the 19th century.
Did size actually translate to military superiority?
It actually did not in this particular instance. But the other thing that Frederick William did that had a huge influence was that he increased the size of the army in terms of the number of people in it, from almost doubling it to nearly 80,000 in the time of his rule. And this had the carryover effect of other countries in Europe also increasing the size of their armies. And it was at this point that human beings began to get measured in a systematic, organized fashion for the very first time.
But then Napoleon had to reduce the minimum height of his soldiers in order to conscript enough men to fight his wars. He was pretty successful.
Well, it's interesting that this the follow-up to this is sort of the echo of Frederick Wilhelm, is that by the time you get to Napoleon and he's fighting all these European campaigns and at tremendous loss of life and limb, he's lowering the minimum height requirement for French men to join the French army in order to keep the size of the army up.
So he's allowing 4Fs to come into the military.
Exactly. Right? And if you look at growth, there's some argument that the average stature of a French male in the early 19th century actually takes a little dip because of this.
And French people are shorter than most other Europeans.
A little bit, yes.
So that had a lasting effect. Can we say that short parents tend to have short children and tall parents tend to have tall children?
Generally, the height of a child falls within a range of the midpoint between the two parents. And so the genes make a big difference, but the environment also accounts for a big part of that variation. One of the interesting things that growth scientists, again, have been aware of for well over a century is that the average height of various populations in the world has been going up, and it's been going up in such a short period of time that it cannot be a genetic change. It has to be environmental.
Well, we are seeing that in some countries where people tended to be shorter, and then milk, for example, enters into the diet. But the United States, we've been kind of static over the last couple of decades, whereas Europeans are getting taller.
In the last 50 years, the average height of American males has been pretty much pretty level. There are two possible explanations for that. One is that because of immigration, we have a much richer ethnic mix, and there's differences in physical size of different ethnic groups, and that could be a contributing factor. And the other thing is a paucity that's pointed out by some other countries. The tallest people in tallest men in the world at the moment is in the Netherlands. It's pretty well known that they're the tallest men in the world.
That's because the country's below sea level.
Well, shortly followed by the Scandinavians. And the question is, why have they been growing so much and why are they so tall? Although the answer is not definitive, I would say the leading explanation at this point is that in these countries, the prenatal and perinatal, shortly after birth, care is state-sponsored, institutionalized, and people, it's very good, and people take advantage of it. Whereas in this country, obviously, it's catch-as-catch-can.
My guest is Stephen S. Hall. His book, Size Matters, How Height Affects the Health, Happiness, and Success of Boys and the Men They Become, is published by Houghton Mifflin. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. We were talking about growth charts how doctors started keeping them for the military. Then a very famous anthropologist had an impact on the way we interpret growth charts. Franz Boas.
Franz Boas is mostly known as a physical anthropologist and a collector of cultural history and so on. But he's actually one of the most influential growth scientists in the last 100 to 150 years. He was the one who understood that the rate of growth is the most important indicator of a child's healthy development. And in fact, this gets back to those measurements that are wrong all the time. In order to establish the rate of growth, you need a sequence of measurements. And if they're wrong, you don't have an accurate measurement of how a child grows. The other thing that Boas was deeply involved in was sort of championing the cause of the late developer. That is, children who grew later, he nonetheless thought would reach a normal stature and that were not harmed in any way by being late developers. So he was very influential. Interestingly enough, one of the things he did in preparation for a World's Fair in 1893 in the States was to send anthropologists out to measure Native American populations in the United States. And those records kind of lay in a box unexamined for decades until they were found at the Museum of Natural History here in New York about, I don't know, 20 years ago. And economists have used them to show that the tribes in the American plains were among, if not the tallest people on Earth. And this, again, is used by economists as a kind of quality of life index, especially in these earlier populations, and seems to suggest that the welfare of children in these particular societies was especially treasured and taken care of.
But even in the on the Atlantic coast, the Native Americans were taller than the Europeans who were coming over. So I guess they also had better diets. You visited the British scientist Jim Tanner. How did he change the growth chart?
James Tanner is, in my opinion, not only the greatest growth scientist of the 20th century, I think he's actually one of the best scientists that I've encountered in my career as a science writer. And he influenced many different areas. One of the things he did in England that I think was really exceptional and has kind of fallen by the wayside is he understood that because children grow in such a variable way, that the definition of normality has to take this into account. And so what he did is he created growth charts that were, one set was for early maturing boys and girls, one was for late maturing boys and girls, and one set was for boys and girls who mature more or less on average. And when you see these charts side by side, you understand that that children follow a vast number of different trajectories to get to what's normal at the end of growth. You see that less in the kind of charts that we do in this country because they're based on different kinds of data sets. And so those charts in England, I think, were very influential. And unfortunately, they were supplanted, he told me, by the fact that drug companies distributed this other type of growth chart in England and eventually kind of replaced the Tanner charts. But they're very interesting. And I know some pediatric endocrinologists in this country would like to use them more often.
You've written about Charles Atlas. I remember those ads in the comic books where the big bully kicks sand in the 98-pound weakling's face. A mother has called in and wants to know why this prejudice against short kids or small kids that allows teasing or bullying is allowed when we would never allow similar things if the kids were of a different nationality or of a different race.
It's an excellent question. I think, again, in the society of growing boys, there's a kind of trickle-down effect, and it's almost a classic dominance hierarchy that you even see in some other animal species, that the
sort
stronger...
Sort of the thing we see in the chimpanzees.
Exactly. Right? The stronger and the bigger sort of pick on the lesser, and it keeps trickling down. And it's the smallest children in particular who catch a lot of this. Now, I have to say that schools are a lot better about being vigilant against physical bullying than they were when I went to school. And I had my experiences even up to high school when I was at the first percentile, so I was quite small. But one of the episodes I recount in the book is not only being bullied in high school, but then tracking down the bully, calling him up on the phone, and having this initially awkward but ultimately pleasant conversation where I basically said, we haven't talked in 40 years and you probably haven't thought of my name, but you did this to me in freshman year in high school, and do you recall it? And he was deeply chagrined, but we realized that, again, it was so important to be physically, establish your physical identity during those years, and I think that played into this a lot.
And you sent away for the Charles Atlas kit. Absolutely. What did you get for your $30?
Well, you get a booklet that sort of gives you a bunch of exercises to do, and I can't say that I was terribly diligent about them. I talk about the Atlas example because it also speaks to the issue of boys and their body image and how that's changed. If you look at pictures of Charles Atlas now, he doesn't seem particularly remarkable. He seems in very good shape, but he doesn't seem sort of monstrously fit the way some of today's bodybuilders appear. But I think that's become the model for a lot of boys. And a lot of boys, there's indications that, for example, that boys are using steroids now, not to build for muscles, but just for the look of it. So in this very physically conscious society of ours, it's seeping down to boys as it has for girls for many decades.
There are some theories about the significance of being tall as an indicator of success in later life and even in earning power. How did statisticians explain the difference in compensation for tall people as a cultural preference? As a, are there socioeconomic factors?
There are. It's a very complex question, and economists have been trying to attack it. There was a study that came out a couple of years ago. It was very interesting. It correlated higher income with tallness, but not the tallness of the adult males. It was the tallness of these individuals during adolescence when they were 16 years old.
That's the key, 16?
That was the, in this particular finding, that was the key. And the suggestion was that boys who were taller at that particular age probably enjoyed greater athletic success, social success, and that this translated in some sort of self-esteem and self-confidence that they called human capital.
Does small size have any evolutional benefits? A caller says that a new study indicates short people live an average of 5 years longer than tall people.
There has been work that suggested that shorter people live longer. Interestingly enough, Charles Darwin has suggested at one point that he thought it might be an immense advantage, and those were his exact words, for humans to have evolved from a smaller and weaker creature. And the reason for that was that he realized that that would create a selective pressure for what he called the higher mental qualities, but not just intelligence, but also what we now call social intelligence. And if you talk to primatologists, they will tell you that the sort of old model of the alpha male has really begun to succumb to a much more sophisticated and nuanced understanding that you may, physical size may help you become dominant, but it won't let you stay dominant unless you develop social skills of cooperation and so on.
As we learn from Lord of the Flies.
Exactly. there's been animal research recently that suggests that animals, there's not necessarily just this inborn need to dominate, but that there's also a cultural component. Even in baboons, you see this, that societies change on the basis of cultural behavior. So it's not just in our genes.
Stephen S. Hall's book, Size Matters, How Height Affects the Health, Happiness, and Success of Boys and the Men They Become, is published by Houghton Mifflin. Thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.